As an introduction, Brother Mike's third class, he's asked us to read from Psalm 84, and Brother Josh Bates is going to read that for us.
Psalm 84. How amiable are thy tabernacles, O Lord of hosts! My soul longeth, yea, even fainteth, for the courts of the Lord. My heart, my flesh, crieth out for the living God. Yea, the sparrow hath found an house, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may lay her young, even thine altars, O Lord of hosts, my King and my God. Blessed are they that dwell in thy house. They will be still praising thee. Blessed is the man whose strength is in thee, and whose heart are the ways of them, who passing through the valley of Baca, make it a well. The rain also filleth the pools. They go from strength to strength, every one of them in Zion appeareth before God. O Lord, God of hosts, hear my prayer. Give ear, O God of Jacob. Behold, O God, our shield. Look upon the face of thine anointed. For a day in thy courts is better than a thousand. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of wickedness. For the Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord will give grace and glory. No good thing will he withhold from them that walk uprightly. O Lord of hosts, blessed is the man that trusteth in thee.
Brother Mike's third class is entitled, Because His Mercy Endureth Forever.
Okay. No one's fallen asleep on me yet? We're all good? Yeah? Okay. So, we're just going to pick up right where we left off. So, you remember we ended talking about the sons of Korah, how incredible they were as a group of believers, those who once again took the difficult road of separating themselves from those who rebelled against God, basically, at the end of the day, right? Who fell, who were the apostasy. And so, they separated themselves from the tents of wickedness, come what may. They said, that is the right choice, that's what we're going to do. And then they found their way into every part of the spiritual kingdom of David that they could. They were his mighty men, they were his gatekeepers, they were his singers, and they were a whole host of other things when you look at the lineages and the genealogies and all the rest in Chronicles and in Kings. So, an amazing family, right? But they're not the only family that's amazing. There's another family that we need to talk about a little later on in this class, which is the family of Asaph, another family of Levi, okay? An incredible family to be inspired by in our day and age. And so hopefully we'll be able to do that as we go through this class. What I want to do is change a bit of the perspective that we've been looking at these individuals through, which is the records in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. I want to switch it up, and we're going to look at it through a lot of the Psalms and what the Psalms have to say. Because we have Psalms from the sons of Korah. We have Psalms of Asaph. So why not look at what they're thinking and what they're writing in songs to understand their frame of mind? And I think it's just another angle that we can get to understand these amazing spiritual people that we want to be like, that also were like Christ. Before we do that, though, we need to ask a few questions about the Psalms. Because when I read the Psalms of the sons of Korah, I see Psalms that I feel can't be written by the actual first generation of the sons of Korah. So the psalm we just read, I believe, was written at a time when Israel was in captivity, right? It's talking about, oh, how lovely are your courts, O Lord. You know, even the bird, even the sparrow can find a home, but I can't. I'm stuck in some other place and I can't get to where I really want to be, right? So, you know, that's the sons of Korah is what it says, right? Psalm 84, on an instrument of Gath, a psalm of the sons of Korah. How lovely is your tabernacle? Well, of course they would have known how lovely the tabernacle was. They lived by it every day. They touched it, they felt it, and they had everything to do with God's tabernacle. My soul longs, yes, even faints for the courts of the Lord. Well, why did they faint for him when they were actually working on them? So I wonder if this is actually done from captivity. And they're talking about not just the tabernacle, but the actual temple. Right? Because tabernacle just means a living place, right? It can be a tent, or it can actually be a dwelling place. So I wonder if that's what's happening here. And if that's the case, then it can't be by the actual sons of Korah. Who's this written by? So that's one of the questions I have. And I think there's a few other questions that we got to think about. When it comes to David and all of a sudden there's an explosion of psalms. Why? Why in David's time did he set up a whole other layer on top of worship at the temple that was dedicated to singing and praise? It wasn't at the tabernacle. God hadn't said, hey, here's all the layout for the tabernacle. Okay, you got that. Now, I want to make sure that you make all the holy things according to what I say. This much gold, this wood, this much cloth, all those things. And also, I want you to also put into place a whole singing choir. And I want you to write songs that fit what they're supposed to be singing. That's never mentioned in the law, is it? So why did David go and add that on top of everything that he had received, you know, through the years from God, through Moses, and through the law? Why did he need to add that? So we need to ask that question. How about this? How important was singing in the time of David? Did it really have an important role? This is where we're going to see a lot of these psalms coming from. And then, is the Psalm of Asaph actually written by Asaph? Which kind of speaks to my point where I don't know if some of these psalms were actually written by the man Asaph, because some of them seem to be coming from somewhere different. And we'll see that as we look through some of the psalms. So I'll tell you a book that's really helped me understand the psalms. Brother Mark Vincent, he's a brother that I think used to live in the Boston area or in the somewhere up there, I think Massachusetts. But he's originally from England or Scotland or something. But he wrote a book, Exploring the Psalms. So some of you might know him. Before I knew him, I read this book. And it blew me away. It's a fantastic book, Exploring the Psalms. It's not a book that goes through every psalm and helps you to understand every psalm. What it does is it helps you to explore the Psalms on your own. It gives you great tools about understanding maybe some of the Hebrew language, what poetry really is all about, what some of the writers mean when they say certain things, what Hebrew parallelism is and what it's not. So it goes through the Psalms and really helps you understand how to study the Psalms for yourself. So I found it absolutely helpful and a great tool. So I'd like to recommend that to you. And I'd also like to quote a few things from it right now. Because I think some of the things that Mark Vincent says helps us answer how important singing and music and the Psalms were at the time of David and afterwards as well. I think there's some interesting things that he has to say. So, first of all, let me answer the question of, you know, why was there so much music in the time of David, but there wasn't before? And this is not proof by any means. It's just maybe some thinking, maybe a little speculation, and if you don't like speculation, close your ears. But I find sometimes it can be really helpful to think through why certain things were said or done. So let me read a quote or two. So to answer the question, why was there music in the time of David but not before, here's a quote from Mark Vincent's book. You tell me what you think about this. Worshippers at the tabernacle, so beforehand, worshippers at the tabernacle would not be overcome by an ecstatic frenzy, like pagan worship, which you can imagine was happening when the golden calf was made, but would worship in an atmosphere which encouraged them to think solemnly about what they were doing. Perhaps in this manner of their worship, the children of Israel were taught to differentiate themselves from the nations. Possibly, it was only later that that Israel, under the leadership of David, gained the spiritual maturity for music to be introduced into their worship. So what Mark Vincent is saying is, at the time that the tabernacle was built in the wilderness, Israel had just come out of Egypt. They were like a baby, just coming out, right, spiritually speaking. So what he's saying is, maybe if you had introduced the aspect of music and a lot of the emotion that goes with music, it would have actually been a great detriment to Israel. Because we know that what did Moses hear when he came down from the mountain? He heard singing and dancing, right? And that was just a part of the package. Not that singing or dancing was evil in itself, right? Because we know it's not. But it's in the context of all the wickedness that was going on around that golden calf. Throwing off of all their morality, they're just doing whatever they wanted there in their right, and they're doing what was right in their own eyes. So maybe there's some truth to that. Introducing music and all the rest of the emotion that goes with it wouldn't have been a good thing if you had it at the tabernacle. But let's fast forward. All the learnings and what my grandpa used to call the school of hard knocks that they went through in the wilderness, they're past that now. They've come into the land. They've gone through some horrible times in the Judges. And now they've come to David. And David is a great man of faith. He's got weaknesses just like any of us. But he has a lot of faith. And he has a lot of vision. And God uses him in incredible ways, right? As a type of Christ. So maybe by that time, the nation was at a place that when David introduced worship in an institutional way, right? It wasn't just a song here or there. It was actually embedding it into the spiritual fabric of Israel. By that time, they were ready for it. And they appreciated it. And they could read the Psalms, and they could sing the Psalms, and they could appreciate God in it, and not just debase themselves down to the golden calf kind of thing. So maybe that's an answer to that. So here's one of the other questions. What about the titles of the Psalms? So when a Psalm says things like a Psalm of Asaph, was it actually written by the man Asaph or somebody else? This is what he has to say about that. It's incorrect to assume automatically that it means that the very person whose name is attached wrote the psalm. Indeed, sometimes it's unlikely. So for instance, he actually goes to Psalm 72. Let's just go over there for a second. Look at the title of this psalm. Psalm 72, a psalm of David. This is what my New King James says. What's the King James say? Same thing? Psalm 72. Psalm of Solomon, okay? So that leads you to believe that this is a psalm that Solomon wrote, okay? But when you read it, it doesn't seem to make sense that Solomon wrote it. What was that? Yeah, it very well could be. So when you read things like verse, let's just say, starting at verse 1. Give the king your judgments, O God, and your righteousness to the king's son. He will judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice. The mountains will bring peace to the people and the little hills by righteousness. So it's kind of talking about Solomon. It'd be kind of weird if he wrote this about himself. And I think to Andrew's point there, I think this might have been written by David or someone like that, his father. It's a psalm for Solomon. And so what Mark Vincent's point is, this one doesn't make sense if you just say by Solomon or of Solomon. This meaning is just, here I'm reading a quote again. This meaning is just as possible as far as the Hebrew is concerned. And the content of the content of the psalm makes sense if we assume it to be a psalm written by David for his son Solomon. And so he gives a few other examples of where the same phrase is used. When we see that phrase, a psalm of whoever, it could mean by, it could mean of, and it could mean for. Or it could mean to. So we don't have any clarity written from this. We got to understand the psalm, and then maybe we can make a good guess on who actually wrote it or who it's for. But we can't just trust when it says of Solomon that that's definitely what it's about. So that'll make sense as we go through and we look at Song of the Sons of Korah. Then that starts to make sense. It's not necessarily by them. It could have been for them. Or this is what Mark Vincent says. We may compare the different uses of the English word to in the sentence, I want to go to school at 10:29. Every time it's used differently in the English language, but you understand that word to means different things throughout that sentence. So that's what the Hebrew word is kind of like. So he says, in light of these facts, perhaps the best way to translate the preposition in the Hebrew when it appears to signal authorship is therefore to treat it as if it were an adjectival ending. How about that word? You like that? So what he says is, instead of calling it a psalm of David, instead call it a Davidic psalm. Almost like a genre. So it's a Davidic psalm because it talks about these elements. Maybe it's mercy. Maybe it's God's, you know, the kingship or something like that, which makes it a Davidic psalm. Now, some psalms were absolutely written by David. There's no question about it. Jesus even verifies that and confirms it in some of the New Testament passages. But it doesn't mean that just because it says Psalm of David that you can absolutely say it's a Psalm of David. Okay? Interesting. Likewise, if it's a Psalm of Asaph, it could be an Asaphite psalm. It's in the genre that Asaph would have written it. So just keep that in mind when we're going through this, because sometimes it doesn't make sense otherwise. And then lastly, the one other question, how important was music at the time of David? Okay, and the reason we're getting into all this is because we're going to see that the sons of Korah show up in music in the time of David, and we're going to see that Asaph does as well, right? So we got to get a firm foundation of the Psalms and understand how they fit in. But that third question, how important was it? Here's a quote from Mark Vincent, the last one I'll give you. It is important to notice the scale and thus the importance of what David instituted. 1 Chronicles 23 records that 4,000 men were appointed as porters and another 4,000 to make music. So there was just as much that were involved with music as those who were serving the tabernacle, the temple itself. So it's big. It's on a big scale, right? These are considerable numbers, he says, even when account is taken of the fact that they did not all serve at the same time, being instead divided into courses, which served at different times during the year. Another 288 were instructed in the songs of the Lord. Perhaps these were choir leaders of some kind. So you had more than 4,000 people involved with singing, basically around the clock at the temple. That's a lot of people, even when you divide that up throughout the week and throughout the different shifts. So that's pretty amazing when you think about the scale that David gave. And these people had to eat, so they were employed by David. You know, this is a whole system that's very important to him. So that's a little bit of background of the Psalms. So what we do know is that there's quite a few Psalms of the sons of Korah, and then we know there's quite a few Psalms of Asaph. Okay, Asaphite Psalms, however you want to call it. What I'd like to do is just delve in for a minute, going back to Korah, into some of the things that we see in the Psalms. Okay, this is just a quick chart here. There's a ton more, but these are the biggest ones I'd love to share with you just for a minute. When we compare Korah to the sons of Korah in the Psalms and what they say, we see the exact opposite. You know, when we say, why do the sons of Korah choose to leave the tents of wickedness, right? Well, I feel the Psalms give us some understanding of that. And we can see their motivation, which we can't usually see. You know, a lot of times we see events in Kings and Chronicles. We don't know what people's motivations were and what they were thinking. But in the Psalms, it looks like we can. So just take a look at this, right? So these are all Psalms, well, not numbers, but Psalm 42, 44, and 84 are all Psalms of the sons of Korah. Just a couple of them, really, right? But look at the difference that we have here between the two groups, right? Korah, they're diametrically opposed. He strove against God. His sons pant after the Lord, right? They pant after him, right? Psalm 42, a famous psalm. That's the sons of Korah. They're not opposing themselves. They're panting after him, right? Obviously, they all perished, but the sons of Korah died not, right? That beautiful little verse that has so much meaning. How about this? Number 16:13. They forgot about all of God's promises, and Moses and Aaron bring that up. Have you forgotten about God's promises? And in Psalm 44, verse 1, they remembered God's great deeds that he did among men. So the sons of Korah remember all those things. The sons of Korah had forgot, or Korah himself had forgotten all those things. It says that they remembered Egypt. They brought up Egypt, right, in their rebellion, number 16. Whereas you look at what Korah remembered, their heart turned not back. They would not look back at Egypt, right? That's what we learned from their Psalms. And then lastly, we know that they perished in their own tents, whereas what we just read, the sons of Korah, they want to live in the tents of God. And they think those are the most lovely tents that you could possibly be a part of. So just so diametrically opposed. Son, father, right? And whatever the lineage is of the sons of Korah that existed. So that's pretty neat. Listen to these. I'm just going to read these to you. I'm not even going to tell you where they come from. These are all from Sons of Korah Psalms. And just listen to these phrases and try and picture the sons of Korah in the way that they think, as opposed to the way their father thinks. Neither have we dealt falsely with thy covenant. Forget your own people also, and your father's house. God is the king of all the earth. How about this? We will read this one. Take a look at Psalm 49. Psalm 49, verse 11. Now just keep in mind the context of Korah, right? So as you can see at the beginning, to the chief musician, the psalm of the sons of Korah. So it's whether it was written by the sons of Korah, it was in the genre of the sons of Korah. But take a look there, verse 11. Keep in mind, like I said, the sons of Korah, right? Their inner thought is that their houses will last forever, their dwelling places to all generations. They call their lands after their own names. Think about Korah thinking, or sons of Korah thinking about their father. Nevertheless, man, though in honor, does not remain. He's like the beasts that perish. This is the way of those who are foolish and of the posterity who approve their sayings. Like sheep they are laid in the grave, death shall feed on them. The upright shall have dominion over them in the morning, and their beauty shall be consumed in the grave, far from their dwelling. But God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, for he shall receive me. Think of that, they were redeemed from the grave, right? Instead of just being swallowed up by the earth, they've been redeemed. Do not be afraid when one becomes rich, when the glory of his house is increased, for when he dies, he shall carry nothing away. His glory shall not descend after him. How about that? Right? Verse 20, a man who is in honor yet does not understand is like the beasts that perish. And I think that's how sons of Korah thought about their father. Here's a man who does not get it. He didn't get the service aspect of it. He didn't appreciate what God had given him. But the sons of Korah did. And so that's amazing. Take a look at Psalm 88. Once again, another psalm of the sons of Korah. So we're just brusquely going through these, just taking a look at some of the things. Look at the title on this one. A psalm of the sons of Korah, to the chief musician, set to Mahalalath Leanoth, a contemplation of Heman, the Ezrahite. So this is that same Heman, right? So we talked about how Heman was a descendant of Korah, right? He was one of those sons of Korah down the line. That was at the time of David, that David chose the three great singers to be a part of his worship in the temple. So here he is, he writes a psalm. And when it says Heman the Ezrahite, Ezrahite is not just a title, but you know what it actually means? It actually means a native as rising out of the soil. And you just think of this picture. Heman, a son of Korah, basically was a man who had risen out of death. He escaped death narrowly, right? From being in the tents of his father. And here he is writing a psalm. So it's not really his genealogy, but it's his status. He's a man who's risen out of the soil because of God's mercy. And so he pleads with God to remember that he can't praise him from the grave. That's what this psalm is about. So we see ourselves in the sons of Korah. Those spared by God's mercy and our choice to separate ourselves to him. And this is what living in the truth is all about. Korah's sons wanted to be remembered by the title Sons of Korah. Why would you ever want to remember Korah? Why would you ever want to think of his name, the man who you narrowly escaped from in death? I think it's because that's their starting point. Right, brothers and sisters? We talked about how important humility is, meekness. That's their starting point. That's where we began. We left that tent of wickedness, but he was our father, and that's where we came from. So you think of that. That's a powerful lesson. So I want to talk about Asaph now. I think we're kind of tied some loose ends together, hopefully, on the sons of Korah, although there's a lot more about them that we could look at, especially about them being gatekeepers and what that means in the temple. How we read that in Psalm 84 talks about them wanting to be doorkeepers in the temple of God, which was a huge job and a great privilege. But let's move on to the family of Asaph. So we're kind of leaving behind the whole Korah thing, his sons living after he had died. And we're just going to move over to another faithful family of the tribe of Levi, and that's Asaph and his family. And there's some neat comparisons that you can do between him and between him and Korah, and sons of Korah, I guess I would say. You could say that, well, they're both Levites. They're both singers, right? We know that there's sons of Korah that were singers. They're both distinguished by their great faith in Scripture. That's definitely called out. They're faithful from generation to generation. We're going to get back to that. We're going to talk about how faithful Asaph's family was. They both ended up being very close to David, and they both existed before and after the captivity. So the captivity that we know happened, Zedekiah was taken off the throne, everyone was led away, Nebuchadnezzar, and then brought back, right? And we have Nehemiah and Ezra, the rebuilding of the temple. We know that they existed before that captivity and after. So they were faithful from generation to generation to generation. And we'll talk about how long they were faithful for that we can see. But they're different. Okay, so Asaph is from Gershon. Remember the families, Merari, Gershon, and Kohath? So Asaph is from Gershon. He's mentioned first in David's time. We don't hear about, there's no family of Asaph before that time. And he's distinguished especially in worship, and he definitely comes from a spiritual background, whereas Korah, sons of Korah came from a rebellious and a wicked background. So we have at the time of David an incredible peak of spirituality in the kingdom of Israel. He leads it, but it's not just him that's involved in it. There are the three singers that he puts in charge of temple worship, Asaph, Heman, and Ethan, or Jeduthun is his other name. So there's those three individuals. These three men led the new outpouring of spiritual energy and emotion by singing with their families and others around the clock at the center of the kingdom, Zion. And so we have Asaph, who's chosen even above Heman and Jeduthun, or Ethan. He's right there. He's David's top man when it comes to the singing of his choirs. And we know he's an absolutely faithful man. Let's just take a look. 1 Chronicles 15. Take a look here. This is where we're introduced to him. 17 to 19. Let's read these verses. 1 Chronicles 15, 17 to 19. So the Levites appointed Heman, the son of Joel, and of his brethren, Asaph, the son of Berechiah, and of their brethren, the sons of Merari, Ethan, the son of Cushiah, and with them their brethren of the second rank, Zechariah, Ben, Jaziel, Shemariath, Jehiel, Uni, Eliah, Benaiah, Messiah, Mattathiah, Eliphalel, Micniah, Obed-Edom, and Jael, the gatekeepers. So they kind of this dual role. They're singers, but they're also gatekeepers. The singers, Heman, Asaph, and Ethan, were to sound the cymbals of bronze. And the thought is that sounding the cymbals of bronze was actually the most important function of the choir, because they're the ones that kept the tempo. They're the ones that led the worship when it was supposed to start and when it was supposed to stop. So that was like the leadership role within the choir, and that's what Asaph was a part of, along with Ethan and Heman. So that's his role. Now look at what happens. 1 Chronicles chapter 16, right? So we have David, who wants to bring the ark back to Jerusalem, into the temple. And we know it wasn't there beforehand. We're not going to get into all the details of why. But basically David says, look, it's not right that I dwell in this beautiful house and the ark of God dwells in a tent. Let me bring it up to Jerusalem. And so to do that, he employs Asaph. And I want to show you something I just love about Asaph. So we have, take a look there, verse 7, 1 Chronicles 16, verse 7. Momentous occasion, the ark being a manifestation of the strength of God, and David says, let's bring it to Jerusalem. What is it doing out in the tent? Who am I going to get to lead spiritual worship on that day? Asaph. Right? I'm going to go to Asaph. He's a Levite. Verse 7. On that day, David first delivered this psalm into the hand of Asaph and his brethren to thank the Lord. Oh, give thanks to the Lord. Call upon his name. Make known his deeds among the peoples. Sing to him, sing praises to him, talk of all his wondrous works. Glory in his holy name. Let the hearts of those rejoice who seek the Lord. Seek the Lord in his strength. Seek his face evermore. Remember his marvelous works which he has done, his wonders and the judgments of his mouth. O seed of Israel, his servant, you children of Jacob, his chosen ones. And so this psalm goes through and just has some beautiful language within it. Some beautiful things that it says. Within this psalm, what we have is a phrase that comes in over and over and over again in the lives of Asaph and his descendants. And the phrase is, for his mercy endures forever. His mercy endures forever. So it's in this psalm here, 1 Chronicles 16, but it's throughout a lot of what Asaph does. And I want to show you. So David delivered this psalm into Asaph's hand and says, basically, this is the masterpiece that I want us all to be singing when we're bringing the ark to Jerusalem. Okay? So that's what's going on. Take a look at the end. Verse 37. Okay? So we have the temple, the ark has been brought to the temple, right? The song has been sung. Verse 37, oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endures forever. And then you come down to verse 37. So he, David, left Asaph and his brothers there before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, to minister before the ark regularly, as every day's work required. So he's left. That's his job. He's basically come to his job. So he's come up with the ark, with that beautiful song that he's singing and leading, for his mercy endures forever. That's the cry that Asaph has. And he's left there before the ark to sing. And basically the whole spiritual worship part of David's ministry is now set in motion. And Asaph leads that. So what a beautiful picture we have. And what I see through Scripture, when we look at the family of Asaph, as it evolves, when we look down the generations, they've stuck with this phrase, his mercy endures forever. It was first delivered to Asaph, but it stuck with his family, almost as like his mission to remember. God's mercy never ends. It endures forever, no matter what happens, no matter how crazy life gets. God's mercy endures forever. And it comes in the strangest context. And I want to show you that, actually. So if we take a look here, when we come to some of the events that go throughout Asaph's life, what you're going to find, and this is not, like, once again, this is not exhaustive. I'm just showing you some of, the, I think, the biggest ones. In each of these chapters, what you'll find is the family of Asaph is present. They're either leading worship, they're singing along with others, they're in the priestly service. Whatever they're doing, the family of Asaph is present during these occasions. Okay? And think of these occasions are quite different. Here you have the ark being brought to Jerusalem, like we just read, right? They're left there to sing. You have in 2 Chronicles 5, the dedication of the temple. So this is under Solomon, right? The next generation. Maybe Asaph's kids. Here they are at the dedication of the temple. What are they singing? They're singing for His mercy endures forever. In every one of these circumstances, that phrase comes up. His mercy endures forever. Then you move on. Singers, 2 Chronicles 20. Jehoshaphat, you'll remember him, right? A faithful king, made some mistakes, right? Kind of allied himself a little bit with Ahab. But he's a good king overall. And when he sees the enemies, I believe it's the Syrians, coming down to attack, what does he do? Does he go get out his guns and his army? No. He goes and grabs the singers. And at the front of those singers is the family of Asaph. And they're singing, as they're marching out, they're singing, "For His mercy endures forever," before this huge army that's about to attack them. And God saves them. Not because of their prowess and their military ability, but because they had faithful singers who were singing, "God's mercy endures forever. We believe it, and we're willing to march head on into an army to prove it." And God saves them for that. Same family. I don't even know how many years between Solomon and Jehoshaphat. Maybe we would say like 100, 200, something like that. Long time, brothers and sisters, when you think about where are your kids going to be? Where are their kids going to be? Are they going to somehow inherit pieces of what the truth mean to you? Are they going to understand the same principles that we live by studying their Bibles? For His mercy endures forever. And lastly, you have down at the end here, Ezra 3 verse 11. As they're once again dedicating the foundation of the temple, you have the family of Asaph there singing, "For His mercy endures forever." Now we're talking 500, 600 years that the family of Asaph has been in existence, and they're still singing this phrase that came when David handed it to Asaph and said, "I want you to sing this when I'm bringing the ark up to Jerusalem." 500 is, I have no idea if there'll ever be any Robinsons around in 500 or 600 years if the Lord remains away, right? But here's a family that's stuck with what's the most important thing to them. Who cares about anything else? Think about it. When it comes down to it, what's more important than understanding that God's mercy endures forever? I can't think of much. God's mercy endured forever, and that's shown in the way that He's provided Christ as a sacrifice for us. God's mercy endures forever, and He allows us to breathe every day. He allows us to have children that we can preach to give us life. These are all because God's mercy is endured forever. That's incredible fun. And so you can see the strength of Asaph as he passes this lineage down from generation to generation to generation. But I don't want you to go away thinking that Asaph is like a super spiritual man. That somehow he did something that we couldn't. Because that's not the case. When we look at Asaph, he's a man like us. He has the same weaknesses and doubts that we have. So we've seen the strength of Asaph and how he's passed down this truth to his sons and his sons' sons. But I want to show you a different side of him. A man that struggles. Take a look at Psalm 73. Once again, let's look through a few of the Psalms that Asaph or those in his lineage wrote. And we'll get a little taste of how he thought, not just what he did. Psalm 73. Take a look here. Here's a Psalm of Asaph. Look at verse 2. A man that had a faithful family for 500 years, and he was able to say this: "As for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped." Why? Why was a man that was so faithful struggling? Well, it's because I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. I looked around me, I saw wicked people that somehow, through their corruption, or their, you know, just whatever means that there was at their availability, they were wicked and they prospered. How can that be right? I believe in a God whose mercy endures forever. And yet, what about His justice on these wicked people that are prospering? I almost stumbled. I almost slipped, he says, right? Take a look at verse 13 and 14. "Surely I have cleansed my heart in vain." You know, I've been trying to do good, and I've done it in vain. and washed my hands in innocence. For all day long I have been plagued and chastened every morning. He's got serious issues, right? Verse 22, I was so foolish and ignorant. I was like a beast before you. This is the man who had a family that was faithful for 400, 500, 600 years. But he struggles. But at the end of the day, look at what he says in verse 26. My flesh and my heart may fail, but it doesn't matter. Because at the end of the day, God is the strength of my heart and He's my portion forever. So you can see this weakness, this side of Asaph that we can identify with. Take a look at Psalm 74. It's the same thing. Take a look at verse 1, another Psalm of Asaph. Oh God, why have you cast us off forever? Why does your anger smoke against the sheep of your pasture? I thought this was the man who said that God's mercy endured forever. Now he's saying, have you cast us off forever? He's almost traded in his saying for the exact opposite. So here's a man who's just as complicated and confused at times as we are, brothers and sisters. Take a look at verse 10 and 11. Oh God, how long will the adversary reproach? Will the enemy blaspheme your name forever? Why do you withdraw your hand, even your right hand? Take it out of your bosom and destroy them. This is the man who believes in the mercy of God forever. And so you can see that this other side of Asaph is there, and it's revealed in all its sensitivity and its vulnerability through the things he writes in the Psalms for us to see. We see him and those writing with him not only understanding that his own strength is nothing, but questioning God on many things, saying honestly to God, I'm having difficulty in understanding why you are not saving your people. Aren't you our shepherd? Why then do you feed us with the bread of tears and forsake your covenant? Where is your mercy? He actually says that in some of his Psalms. Where is your mercy, your right arm of strength? Have you forgotten about us? So we have in one man and in one family two seemingly contradictory things. Incredible strength, strength that can establish and maintain a spiritual family for over 500 years, and incredible doubt and sensitivity. And brothers and sisters, if that's not living the truth, I don't know what is. It's a contradictory experience, isn't it? You have the flesh on the one side that doubts, that fails. But on the other side, you have, I want to please God. I want to teach these things to my children. I want to preach these things to others. And so that's what we have in these Psalms. And yet, that is exactly what God is looking for, isn't he? He's looking for our frailty, because he can work with that. I'd like to use one more beautiful psalm to illustrate that point. Psalm 77. Now this is, as far as I can tell, it's correct in its title. And let's go with that. We don't know for sure if it is, but what it says here is, to the chief musician, it's to Jeduthun. Remember who Jeduthun was? You remember his other name? Ethan, right? You had those three singers that David set up. Asaph, Heman, and Ethan, or Jeduthun. So you have Asaph, who's writing a psalm to his friend, Jeduthun. It's his right-hand man and singing of the three. He's about to pass this psalm on to his friend. Now, I would think that this psalm would be, praise the Lord, things are good, life is awesome, I'm so blessed. It would be a very positive, upbeat psalm if you're giving it to your friend. You know, you don't want to show all your cards. You don't want to make yourself too vulnerable to your friend. You don't want to explain what really kind of the doubts that you have going on or the mistakes you've made. But Asaph doesn't do that, brothers and sisters. This Psalm 77 opens my eyes up to a deep friendship between two friends, between Asaph and Ethan. And when you look at some of the things that are said here, take a look at verse 8 and 9. These are serious issues that Asaph is going through, he's working through. Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forever? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? These very things are the core of what I believe in. And Jeduthun, I'm sharing these doubts with you. I want you to understand the things I'm thinking and the difficulties that I have that make me almost slip, as it said in another psalm. He's totally honest with his brother, his friend. And I love that psalm for that purpose. Brothers and sisters, this is a template of how we should be with our closest friends in the truth. We don't have to air our laundry to everybody, right? That's not what this is about. But this is about being absolutely honest and open with our good friends in the truth, explaining that there's difficulties in our lives that we're struggling with. And Asaph leads the way here. And that, to me, also lends himself to being a strong character and a template that we should follow. He's able to show the great strength that God has given him through understanding how God's mercies endure forever. He's able to say, I don't got it all. I don't understand this. I am doubting. I'm really struggling in the truth. And so this is the two sides that I see of this man together. I'll tell you what. This is what I want my family to be able to do. You know, we're not just planning our lives in the truth, are we? You know, Christ might return at any time. But until He does, our job is to continue changing little minds that are bent towards evil, just like all of ours. I mean, except for Noah and Melody. But all your children. That's our job. And our job isn't just to tell them how great God is, but it's about telling them our weaknesses and our difficulties. Because that makes it real, brothers and sisters. They can paint that in their minds. They can see how it's hard for Dad to say, please forgive me. And they can understand sometimes why Mom or Dad get angry. Because we explain it to them. We don't just brush it off. But we say, Dad was wrong when he did this. He struggled with this. You need to understand that. This is a picture of the full man or woman in Christ. Right? And that's what we see in Asaph, being honest and open about his failings. And so, we see a lot when we look at Asaph, when we see the sons of Korah, when we've looked at all these different Levites. And it paints a beautiful picture, brothers and sisters, of our ecclesial life and in our families, right? Of being open and honest about the truth, and of trying to help each other through the difficult times. And so, really, brothers and sisters, we come full circle to considering the sons of Korah and the family of Asaph, who chose to be separate to God, as the Levites had done in our first discussion, when they stepped out of the rioting, drunken mob, worshiping a god that was a golden ox. It does not require men and women who have no doubts, who don't feel vulnerable and weak, or that don't have baggage that weigh them down, because we all do. The Levites had all that and then some, brothers and sisters, didn't they? Think about that. Your father being swallowed up in the earth because of his wickedness. That's some baggage. That's some trauma in his life. God is looking for those who obey Him, who turn a curse into a blessing, despite their weaknesses. And God knows that we are weak, as the psalm says. He knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. As for man, his days are like grass. As a flower of the field, so he flourishes. For the wind passes over it, and it's gone. And its place is remembered no more. But the mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear Him, and His righteousness to children's children, to such as keep His covenant, to those who remember His commandments and do them. And in this we see ourselves, don't we? Struggling in our everyday to remain faithful, to lean on God for strength, to remain separate, to teach our children so that they can teach their children about our Father who has done so many wonderful things in times past and for us. And we struggle, as Asaph did, with weaknesses and doubts, as Paul did, as any man of faith did. And these are the very things that God can work with. In our weaknesses, we can be made strong by God. We can forget about trying to pull a Korah, to save ourselves, to try and encourage and try and make others rebel against those who are in place. But rather we can say, I will delight in my weaknesses, because when I am weak, God can make me strong. So, brothers and sisters, as we end this day, the questions that you need to ask yourself are, do you want to be separate? What do you want to be separate for? Do you want your children to grow up in the fear of the Almighty? Do you want to be a doorkeeper in the house of God? Do you want to sing for His good, for His mercy endures forever? And do you want to sing that forever, not just now in our lives that we have? Do you want to lay your heart bare and tell God about your doubts, about the things you don't have answers for, the vulnerabilities you feel and experience? Do you want to forget about the curse that Adam's race has given you, and you want to turn it into a blessing? Do you want to obtain mercy and forgiveness and be close to God, even dwell in His sanctuary, then choose to be a Levite, one that is joined to God, as it means. The exact same blessing and promise is extended to each of us. I'd like to close with one verse. Think of the parallels with Levi and how we started this weekend. They shall be mine. Then those who feared the Lord spoke to one another. And the Lord listened and heard them. So a book of remembrance was written before Him for those who feared the Lord and who meditated on His name. They shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, on the day that I make them my jewels.